It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Trump calls the media the biggest enemy of the country. We're going to look at threats to the First Amendment. But first, we're capping a week of protests, vigils, and Pittsburghers taking to the streets in grief and solidarity for the deaths of two young black men and a Border Patrol policy that left thousands of children stranded, sometimes thousands of miles from their immigrant parents. Joining us to talk about the sparks behind so much unrest this week are two journalists from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, reporter Megan Guza and photojournalist Nate Smallwood, and two from the WESA newsroom, reporter Ann Lee Herring and WESA's government and accountability editor, Chris Potter. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're encouraged to join this conversation. Please email us at confluence@wesa.fm or find us on Twitter. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Folks, at this time on this Friday, the latest protests ended just really a matter of hours ago. Demonstrators shut down a section of the Parkway East in both directions well into the wee hours. Nate, Ann Lee, you were both there. What did you see? Let's start with Ann Lee, then Nate.
Well, initially, the protest was a small rally at the East Pittsburgh police station. And the group there were concentrated in an intersection blocking traffic. And then a rumor started to circulate that police officers were blocking 376 Parkway East. And they thought that the idea was to contain the crowd, to keep people from getting to where they were. So kind of in the spur of the moment, at least it seemed spontaneous, they decided to march the about 3 miles to the interstate.
And this was one of the protests because of the shooting death of 17-year-old Antoine Rose. The unarmed teenager was shot in the back 3 times by East Pittsburgh policeman Michael Rosfeld while fleeing from officers during a traffic stop. Nate, I want to get you. What were your impressions? What did you see?
From East Pittsburgh, moving upwards towards the Parkway East, I think they stopped a number of times. And initially, they thought about going all the way down to the city. There were talks of that. And I think they stopped in different intersections, had a handful of small confrontations with angry drivers, voiced their grievances, and kept going towards the Parkway.
Okay, so that's what you saw. Let's hear from some of the protesters.
Black Lives Matter!
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 I have to keep my spirit strong.
That's right.
That's right.
I have to understand politics and who's doing what and who's not doing what. And we have to put people in positions to change things systemically.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Right. Come on, brother.
What are you going to do?
Are we marching peacefully? Are we going to the Parkway?
Maybe now you'll notice what's going on. You know, stop living in privilege and with a blind eye. And if it doesn't touch your community or your neighborhood, you don't care about it. We're going to make you care.
One of those voices you heard was Leon Ford, a young man who was shot during a traffic stop himself a few years back. So Officer Michael Rosfeld confirmed he was sworn in on the night of the shooting, but said he had been on duty with the department for about 3 weeks, said he'd been a police officer since 2011, previously working for Oakmont, Harmer, and the University of Pittsburgh Police Departments before coming to East Pittsburgh. So, Megan, Ann Lee, Chris, the protest Thursday night was a continuation of marches Wednesday and midday Thursday. What are the broader messages here, do you think? What's the message they want to get out?
I think it's just a matter of, you know, frustration and sorrow and really just being tired of, you know, perceived racial profiling, the shooting of unarmed black men, often by white police officers. The community is just tired.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I just say I'm old enough to remember, as the saying goes, as long as I've been a reporter, this has been an issue. I go back to 1995, which is the first year I became a reporter, and the death of Johnny Gammage.
Johnny Gammage, a motorist who was stopped by suburban police.
Yes, Brentwood police, and then they followed him. They actually, the incident happened inside city limits, but it involved suburban police officers. That wasn't a shooting. It was a case of positional asphyxia. They were pressing down on him while he was on the ground, and he suffocated that way. There have been marches that I have seen time and time again over the years. These incidents keep coming up, as we've seen across the country. And I think we're at this point now of sort of in the wake of Ferguson, in the wake of the Leon Ford shooting, of sort of this mounting frustration that nothing seems to change. Different mayors get elected, different police chiefs come through. Pittsburgh has a police oversight civilian board now. And yet the issue still keeps surfacing time and time again. And I think that's really what you're hearing there.
And on Lee, what's the message that you're hearing from the protesters, the concerned community members?
Well, I agree with Megan that it is a very cathartic experience, I think, for the protesters. In addition to that, they are calling for political engagement and for people who feel like they've been totally disregarded by political leaders to run for office themselves, to vote in elections. I think their most specific call to action right now is to vote District Attorney Zappala out of office.
Zappala has been in office for 20 years now, but they're upset because of the lack of prosecutions or the lack of successful prosecutions of officer-involved shootings or what?
That's the theme of their critique of Zappala. They say that in the past he has chosen not to prosecute officers for shooting civilians for using force against them, and they're, like Megan said, tired of it.
And there's that conundrum, if you would, because the district attorney's office works with the local police forces, and it's a tenuous relationship. And so does that mean, have there been explorations about automatically this is turned over to maybe the state attorney general's office?
Yeah. In fact, I mean, the Black Political Empowerment Project, which is a longstanding organization of African-Americans led by Tim Stevens, a longtime activist in the community, basically has petitioned State Attorney General Josh Shapiro to get involved. He's pointed out that he doesn't have that power, but there is an argument that he should. I think actually, I mean, this is, of course, a concern, the close working relationship between district attorney and police officers. I mean, I think if you take another step back, there's a broader issue there, which is it's also very hard for a jury to convict a police officer. The entire criminal justice system sort of proceeds from the premise that when an officer gets up there and testifies, whether it's a police officer or an officer of the court, they have the authority of the state behind them, and you're supposed to kind of give them the benefit of the doubt. And I think that becomes a much harder thing for a jury to negotiate when it's the behavior of an officer sworn to protect us that's the issue, and that's the subject of a prosecution.
Megan, it's difficult to prosecute officers. They have to prove that they feared for their life. That's not a really high bar.
It's not. It's a fairly low bar, actually. I mean, when you've got a jury of civilians sitting there listening to an officer, they're going to put themselves in that officer's shoes and say, well, what I fear for my life? And right or wrong, there's often more weight given to an officer's word when they're talking about, you know, I feared for my life.
All right. Nate, I want to bring you back in because you have some comparisons for us, if you would. You viewed the protests. You took visuals of the protests. But also, was it now just about four years ago? Mm-hmm. You were in Ferguson, Missouri, for that unrest following the shooting of an individual there as well. Can you give us a sense of perspective, a comparison, if you would?
Yeah, I went out a day or two after the initial days of unrest, I think the second day, and I think just comparing the two, that the protesters in Pittsburgh are, I mean, you kind of had to remember that the goings-on in Ferguson was kind of at the infancy of the Black Lives Matter movement, and there was much less organization than what we're seeing in Pittsburgh. In regards to signing people up to voter registration, but the anger and the sadness are exactly identical.
Yeah, the victim in the Ferguson case was Michael Brown. Mm-hmm. From your profession, mm-hmm. visually, was it similar at all? I mean, you hear it, but you also What did you depict in your work?
It's very similar. The anger and the sadness are exactly the same. The eyes that aren't wet with tears are filled with fire because of how angry they are. And I think that it's disturbingly similar. All the pictures are, the names change, but the sadness is conveyed in the same way.
One more about that, if I might. You hear the voices, you hear anguish, you hear anger, you hear a lot of emotions, but through your work we see emotions as well. Is that difficult, or, you know, for a photojournalist?
Yes, especially a photojournalist of color. It's so much different when it happens in your backyard and you know the people that are going through this. I often don't become emotional. I try and distance myself. And I cover everything objectively either way, but going through all of this in the past couple of days has been extremely difficult. But it's a story that needs covered.
Okay. Megan, you started this week covering a very different vigil. Tell us about Jimmy Wapo.
Jimmy Wapo, his real name is Trayvon Smart. He's a 21-year-old up-and-coming rapper from the Hill District. And very, very popular among the local rap scene. And it was Monday. He was just about to sign on for a 27-stop tour with Wiz Khalifa's label, Taylor Gang. And he'd just gotten off the phone with his attorney, and 15 minutes later, he was killed in a drive-by shooting.
Okay. Wapo got a lot of attention because of his budding music career, but he's hardly the only young black man who has been killed this year. Chris and others, I want you to help us to bring this full circle in terms of focusing on one young man. Does that help call attention to the overall issue of young black men getting killed no matter who the perpetrator is? I mean, focus, because we don't focus on all of the victims, but does that at least help call attention to other victims, maybe indirectly?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to say that it does. I mean, we know names like Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown now are practically household words because of what happened to those folks. I think it's tricky. I mean, as somebody who, you know, produces media, there's always that question of sort of the victim who's sympathetic or whatever, right? Do we pay more attention to an up-and-coming rap artist because they're famous? And we do. And people sometimes, Megan's probably had this experience of having people say, you know, you're ignoring all these other lives. These other Black lives matter too. And I think that's the regret. I mean, obviously the biggest tragedy is that there have been so many of these. And sort of a result of that tragedy is that some get more attention than others, even though I think, you know, all of those lives are important and worth looking at and trying to figure out whether we could be doing something differently in this country to prevent that from happening.
All right. So what is the latest with the Jimmy Wapo case? Do we the investigation? Do we know what's going on here?
Police have, as they are with most investigations, remained, you know, fairly tight-lipped. Because it got so much attention, they put out a statement earlier this week saying as much, you know, we investigate every homicide equally. And as far as we know, no suspects have been named, no arrests made, nothing along those lines.
But that's their standard procedure, not saying much during an investigation. But they almost had to say that, which says really not much.
Right. They had to say that they don't normally say anything.
Okay. It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. We're discussing a week of unrest in the Pittsburgh area caused by some events. The shooting death of an up-and-coming young rapper. Of course, the shooting death by a police officer of a 17-year-old high school student that has caused a number of protests. And also a vigil of Pittsburghers standing in solidarity for immigrant families who have been separated at the border. So all this has been compounded by that Border Patrol policy that President Trump has since reversed, but not before thousands of children were forcibly separated from their parents at the border. Chris, few of those children are being held here in Pennsylvania. I believe about 50 or so in a church facility in Pittsburgh. Others are elsewhere in the state.
Yeah, okay. Just outside the city. And it's a nonprofit that has handled kids in refugee-type circumstances before. You know, I think there's a distinction to be made between a nonprofit like that that's trying to do the best they can in a crisis situation.
And but what's some notable of those is, centers that we've heard about.
Yeah, and those centers. And what's notable here is this crisis is entirely man-made and really largely by one man, and it's the President Donald Trump. And I think we had a conversation on air here that we aired yesterday with David Harris, our kind of WSA in-house legal analyst. And there's real concern here that lasting damage has already been done, and it's not at all clear that all of these kids are going to ever be reunited with their parents at this point. This is a human catastrophe. I think any person of conscience, whatever your position on the immigration issue, is it's already become very apparent that this policy, much like the Muslim ban, people may remember from the early days of the Trump administration, just had this all of a sudden everybody was like, what's happening at the airports? And everybody had to rush out. And Bob Casey was in a tuxedo in Philadelphia or whatever. And we're seeing that here, but written, I think, on a much larger and more tragic scale here. And so this is the president's order sort of reversed what he had wrought before. It's not clear that this new order could pass constitutional muster. And if it doesn't, it's not clear that Donald Trump wouldn't go back to separating families from kids. This is an unprecedented moment in American history, I think.
And the facility that you mentioned here in the Pittsburgh area, is that Holy Family Institute?
I believe that's it. Yeah.
And, of course, you said that's much different from because I remember they've often taken care of children because I remember the devastating Haiti earthquake. A lot of children actually from Haiti came to the Pittsburgh area and were temporarily cared for there.
Yeah, and I just think that's the most remarkable thing about this in a way is that this is an earthquake. This is like a public policy earthquake. This is a public policy tsunami. It is a disaster being inflicted on people that nonprofits are having to pick up the pieces for because of policy decisions deliberately made.
Okay, so Pittsburghers gathered publicly for that vigil earlier this week in support of these immigrant families who were separated at the border. WESA's Lucy Perkins talked to Reverend Vince Kolb, Abby Lee, John Titus, Paulina Michaels, and Vanessa Gurman.
And while the executive order has been freshly signed, let me remind us all that the cages and the tender age detention centers still stand, and the daily dehumanization of refugees in our country seeking asylum does not vanish with the magic stroke of a pen.
Well, a pen on paper isn't going to exactly fix things.
That's a good start, but that's not enough.
Happened. There are still children that have been separated from their families.
Enough is enough.
When they tell you that their dreams belong on another side of a wall or a border, point at those lies and tell them that they are ruthless and diseased and rise to the occasion of your humanity.
Okay, we mentioned that President Trump signed an order reversing policy. But, Chris, there's still the what happens to the children who are still separated. There's even conflicting information. Have some been reunited? How will they be reunited? I even heard that, I hate to put it this way, that a lot of the parents don't even know where their kids are. They didn't, quote, get a receipt for their children.
Yeah, a federal judge down in Texas was hearing a case, I think yesterday or the day before, and the prosecutors, you know, he basically was telling the federal folks, you have to be kidding me. If you go to jail and they take your wallet, you get a receipt for that wallet. They have to fill out paperwork that says we took your wallet, but there's no paper record for taking away the children of these families. I mean, I just think, again, one stands in awe of what has been done here and how with what calloused indifference to the impact on these people and their children who God only knows what conditions some of them are in and their concerns about how they're being treated and the psychological damage being done to them right now by being separated at this early age. This is a trauma and it's being inflicted on these kids who whatever you think about immigration, what do you think about their parents, these kids did nothing to deserve it.
Okay, in our remaining 2 minutes, I want to just look ahead from each of you of what you anticipate, what you're hearing about, of what's going to happen in the days and even next week ahead. Have we heard anything? Do we expect more protests, especially around the shooting death of Antoine Rose? So what have you heard? What are we expecting?
Megan? I think it's quite possible that we'll keep seeing these protests into next week. One of the rallying cries has been, don't let these feelings fade. Don't let the anger fade. Don't forget about this when the next news cycle comes around. Keep going. And I mean, what, you had 2 in 1 day yesterday. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason they won't keep going.
A quick follow-up to you, Megan. Was that one of the bigger protests you saw? Is it, I mean, shutting down the Parkway East?
I have not seen that. I don't know that I haven't seen that happen here. I know there were only...
Normally, maybe, they're like in Market Square and that kind of thing.
Right. And I know this one started as a march, and the march turned into going to the Parkway. I believe there were only maybe 200 last night. But the one the night before in East Pittsburgh, there were hundreds.
Okay. Anli, what do you expect in the days ahead? What are you looking at?
Well, in addition to continuing to following the protests, I'll be waiting to hear what the County Police Department has to say, because they are the agency responsible for investigating the shooting and really have been the ones releasing information on this. The East Pittsburgh Police Department has really not said anything. So I'll just be waiting to hear from them.
And 30 seconds left. I want to get Chris and Nate. And D.A. Zappala said he's not going to comment until after the funeral of Antoine Rose. Nate, what are you looking at?
I think there are going to be plenty more protests. I feel like one of the great fears is to slip past all the attention that's being paid to this and to move on to the next thing. I think great restraint has been shown on both sides in terms of the police's reaction and the protesters remaining to be extremely
peaceful.
Nonviolent. Yes, yeah. Very peaceful.
And very briefly, Chris.
Yeah, I just say, to pick up Megan's point, I've been doing journalism since 1995, and I've never seen a major highway shut down before. Right. So that's a sign of what's going on.
Megan Guz is a reporter at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Nate Smallwood is a photojournalist, also with the Pittsburgh Trib. Anli Herring covers politics for 90.5 WESA. And Chris Potter is the government and accountability editor for WESA. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk to a photojournalist and a refugee from Syria about a new documentary when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The FBI indicted 28 members of a West End gang called the Greenway Block Killers this week. Officials say members of the gang are responsible for murder, shootings, and robberies, and the gang has been active since the 90s. And for the first time in 20 years, Carnegie Lake in Highland Park is stocked with fish like bluegill and largemouth bass. It's part of an effort to get young people outdoors. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. There are an estimated 5 million Syrian refugees forced to flee their home country because of the ongoing civil war. About half of the refugees are in Turkey, which borders Syria on the north. Another million plus in Jordan, which borders Syria on the south. You flee your home, seeking safety for yourself, your family, seeking the basics of life, shelter, food, but also a future. But you are in another country, having to adapt to the culture, learn the language, if you're going to make a life for yourself. This week, Duolingo, the Pittsburgh-based language learning platform, premiered a documentary about the impact of language and education on the lives of some of the refugees. Joining us in studio are award-winning freelance photojournalist Justin Merriman. He's the director of the documentary Something Like Home. Also in studio is Laura Nestler of Duolingo, the producer of the film, and we also welcome Noor, one of the people we meet in this documentary. Welcome to y'all. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
I'm going to start with Justin and Lara. What was the reason, really, for producing this documentary?
You know, Duolingo's mission is to make education free and accessible. And that's firmly rooted in this belief that where you're born should not impact your ability to learn. And over the years, Duolingo has received thousands and thousands of letters. Any email that they can find, we receive emails, physical letters sometimes, sharing their story of what language means to them. But sometimes the letters that come in or the stories that we hear are so impactful that we knew as a company they should be told. Stories of survival.
And Justin, why did you want to become involved in the telling of this story that Laura just mentioned?
Well, for me, you know, I always wanted to be able to go out into the world with my camera and to tell people stories, to use the cliche term, to shed light in dark places. And when Duolingo reached out to me and we talked about this idea, and they kind of said, we don't want this to be an ad. We want this to be journalism. Go do what you do. We don't care if people even mention the word Duolingo. I was on board immediately.
I believe you talked with about 12 different people or so, and 4 individuals are featured in the film. How did you come to focus on those 4?
We did. We interviewed a lot of people, and they all had different reasons why they were learning languages. We met a man in Istanbul who's learning English because his children have moved to Philadelphia, and he wants to one day be able to speak to his grandchildren. We met a couple who fell in love. She is Turkish, and now he needs to speak Turkish to be able to communicate with her. But when these 4 people, their stories about their situation coming from Syria and were really compelling, and we wanted to get a little closer with them.
Noor, you are a software engineer.
Yeah.
And from Syria. Tell us how you came briefly. Why did you have to flee your home, and how did you wind up in Turkey?
You know, you end up in a situation where you can't continue or you're forced to leave. We went to Iraq at first.
You went to Iraq at first?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and the experience was not good because, you know, Iraq has also had been suffering for a long time from war circumstances. Yeah, and then we went to Dubai because, you know, you can get a lot of job opportunities there. But unfortunately, it was the residence visa was rejected due to the nationality.
So what led you to Turkey then?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
You speak several languages, I understand. Yeah. Did you know Turkish before you got to Turkey?
No, I didn't know.
So why was it important for you to learn Turkish? Just to have some chance at success or what?
No, in order to be able to live even the simplest things in life, to communicate with other people around you, all these things is very necessary to learn a language.
Learning Turkish, has it made your living in Turkey a little bit easier?
Yeah, of course. So at the very beginning, I could not speak. So for everything, you can't imagine, I had to ask for help. That was very difficult for me. It's also annoying for others, I think.
But you wanted to be more self-reliant, depend on yourself?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You mentioned that you met with about a dozen people focusing on these 4. I want to get a little synopsis, let people know a little bit about some of the others. What impressed you with 15-year-old Mahmoud? He and his family had moved several times.
29 in the last year.
And in the film, he says, in Syria, one educated person can make an entire family survive. What a mature statement. What a life-affirming statement by that young man.
Just sitting with him, I was in awe. I was in awe because here's this young man who has grown up in a refugee camp. You know, what he maybe doesn't understand that I did is that there's not a lot of opportunity for him right now until there's a resolution in Syria. For his ability to rise out of that camp and begin his life over is very difficult, if not impossible. But yet this kid has not left the situation in Syria affect his dreams, his hope, and his aspirations for the future. He was remarkable. And you saw it in his eyes. You knew that he's been through so much, but yet he is so strong and just so inspiring for me.
Tell us about Hali.
He was, again, another tremendous story. You know,
he's from Damascus. He's 28.
And, you know, he spent a year in jail in Syria for being involved in a protest. And in that year, he sat with his knees to his chest and his arms around his legs and was unable to stand up, to speak, to sleep even. They would keep them up. For a year, he was like that. And yet this, you know, he resettles in Turkey. And beyond just you know, learning a language and starting his life over, he volunteers to help other Syrian children learn computer software and things. I mean, he never stops giving back.
And Laura, then there's Ahmed. He fled with his family to Turkey about 6 years ago, I understand. He's now a citizen of Turkey.
His story really impacted me personally. He has 5 children, but he has 2 sons. I also have 2 sons, and our sons are similar in age. And there's a bit in the film where his sons are coloring a Thomas the Tank Engine coloring book. And my sons have the exact same Thomas the Tank Engine coloring book, except my sons is in English. Mm-hmm. And his sons are, it's in Turkish, because this is the language of their new home. And his sons are actually native, because he's been there long enough that now he is a citizen, his family's, they're all citizens, and they're all together learning Turkish.
Noor, you're now in Pittsburgh. You told us how you got here. You're in these studios, and it's because you have an Iraqi passport.
Yeah.
You mentioned the film, Birth Circumstances Always Govern Our Lives. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think, for example, as a software engineer, let's take an example, an American software engineer and an Iraqi or Syrian software engineer with the same capabilities, they do not have the same chances.
Don't have the same chances.
Yeah, that's obvious. I went to Dubai with good experience, I got various job offers from various companies. But I didn't get the residence visa because of my nationality. Yeah.
It's just so moving, Noor, your story.
Thank you.
Did you find, whether it was talking to the 12 or the 4 that are featured in this documentary, similar links other than having to flee their homeland?
I think what I saw in all 4 of them is this desire to lift themselves up, a strength, a courage. It wasn't saying, help me. It was saying, look at me, help myself. Respect the fact that I'm trying to start my life over and I'm doing these things. They really inspired me beyond words. When we met Noor, she was so well spoken about her situation, but yet you see in her face and in her voice, a pride and a joy, despite the circumstances she's kind of risen out of. And as a woman in this region, it's difficult sometimes. And I think that as a woman, she's a role model for so many others.
Actually, I believe that my circumstances was better than many people.
They were better?
Yeah, of course. I was so lucky. My family was so lucky because many people who are still stuck in the camps right now.
So they're stuck. You got out.
Yeah. We were so lucky.
Did you go in with perceptions of refugees and how did it change?
I think if we just say the word refugee, people have an image. It's a visceral one. We've seen images, unfortunately, and many times that's been a tokenized image. And so when we went in, the goal was to allow their stories to come out and not go in with a plan.
Noor, do you consider yourself a refugee? Or are you just a person seeking a better life, a safe life for yourself?
Yeah, I'm not a refugee, yeah. I'm just seeking a better life, yeah.
What message do you want people who see this documentary to understand? Well, we'll start with you, Noor, first.
Actually, I talked with Justin about this message yesterday.
You were talking with Justin?
Yeah, because I was not sure whether this... about the importance of this video.
Why weren't you sure about the importance?
Because if we were, for example, 100 years before, then we can excuse people because we don't have, at that time, we won't be having these channels. But right now you have TV, you have network, you have Facebook, you have all the communication channels. So everything is just obvious in front of all the people.
She was expressing to me, what does my one voice do in this? And I said, your voice represents a flood, a sea of others. And the fact that, she's part of this film and was willing to open her home, her life up to all of us, I think other people in similar situations will feel a great relief and pride in what she has done and that she echoes their stories.
Laura?
First, I hope that we are able to defy the typical refugee narrative, that these people are not a them, they are an us. Their stories are like ours. Their children want the same thing our children want. Their software engineering skills are as good as ours. And on a larger level, I hope we can illustrate why this is our mission as an organization and why it's so important that where you're born should not impact your ability to learn.
Noor is a software engineer. She's from Syria. She's now living in Turkey. And she's one of the people featured in the documentary Something Like Home. We've also been speaking with Justin Merriman, freelance photojournalist and director of the film, and Laura Nessler of Duolingo, the producer. And finally, where can people see this?
Well, it's available now on duolingomovie.com.
Very good. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Coming up, President Trump has called the media the biggest enemy of this country. How do journalists respond? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the city holds its first LGBT pride parade in 1973. About 150 marchers gathered in Market Square and headed toward Flagstaff Hill in Oakland. The event was held 4 years after the Stonewall riots in New York City, where LGBT people protested police raids and helped start the gay liberation movement in the United States. 45 years later, Pittsburgh Pride events bring in thousands to the city for marches and a celebration of community. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for June 22nd, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We came to the August Wilson Center to talk with some of the participants in a two-day conference hosted by the Pittsburgh Foundation and the Heinz Endowments. 1789 to 2018, the First Amendment for the 21st Century. We'll discuss the state of the First Amendment with Indira Lakshmanan teaches journalism ethics at the Poynter Institute and is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Robert Rosenthal is a board member and executive producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting. And Andy Conti is a former investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and is the founding director for the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University. Thanks to all of you for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
So to each of you, what do you see are the current threats to the First Amendment? Robert, we'll start with you.
We certainly, in terms of the press, in a very adversarial moment, obviously, with the administration. This is not like a new phenomena. Historically, people in power, any administration sees the press as an adversary. But I think right now it's ratcheted up to a level, at least in my lifetime, going back to Watergate, that I think we haven't seen. And part of it is the public nature of it. Part of it is the use of the internet, completely new tools. Part of it is the bifurcation of media. And I think media, when we talk about media today, at least from my point of view, media is different than journalism. And the ability of really anyone to be a publisher through either social media or using the internet and reach vast audiences. And I think, obviously, when the president calls the media or the press the enemy of the people and the whole crisis really around information, that we are at a moment of great risk in terms of not just the First Amendment, but really some of the basis for how societies function, especially democracy, which hopefully is information-based and people can make decisions based on information. But the divide right now, I think, is stronger than we've seen perhaps ever in the United States.
Indira?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there is a time when there has been an administration or a president who's been as hostile to the press as this one. You know, we all know that President Nixon obviously was at war with the press in his own way, but the media climate is completely different now from what it was 40-odd years ago. And the ability of President Trump to get on Twitter at any time that he wants, to be on 24/7 cable news, calling us. I mean, I hate to even repeat the term because I don't want to give it credence, but he very cynically took this term fake news, which in the 2016 campaign was used to refer to actual hoax reports, things that spread on the internet through Reddit, through Facebook, through all sorts of platforms that were false. And he took, and of course, he was offended by studies that showed that false reports, hoax quote-unquote news, because it wasn't news, of course, whether it was created by Macedonian teens who wanted money for sneakers or whether it was created by political and propaganda groups. He was offended by the fact that those circulated. A good study by BuzzFeed showed that there were 1.4 million more shares, likes, engagement on the top 20 fake news headlines of 2016 than on the real news stories from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others. And the president very cynically appropriated that term fake news, turned it around on itself, redefined it to mean the actual real news media. And the problem is the repetition is such, and this is the way the human brain works. The studies show that if you repeat a lie often enough, people start to believe the lie, even if it's not true. So he has really cannily and cynically sort of put out the message that we are the problem, that we're putting out false information. That is, of course, not true. I really love this Berkeley linguistics professor, George Lakoff, who recently was writing about how important it is to state the truth first. Then you can say what the president says if it's false. And then at the end, repeat that what is the actual truth. And we've seen this with fact-checking also. That's a very good and effective way to do it. You can call it so-called a truth sandwich. And one example that's in the news right now is with the immigrant children being separated from their parents. And, you know, headlines need to say things like President Trump reverses his own policy or President Trump ends his policy, instead of just saying President Trump solves the immigrant child crisis, which is what so many media did. So it's a long conversation with lots of threads, but I do think that freedom of the press and the First Amendment are under threat. And there are plenty of studies, including some that we have done at Poynter, that show that people have started to adopt and believe the president's language against the press.
Andy Cundy.
Well, there's no doubt what Robert and Indira said rings true. But I think it's also, we need to keep in perspective the positive things that are happening as well. You've got the democratization of media that's taking place. And so while on one hand you've got the president setting up this adversarial relationship with the media, you've also got, on the other hand, lots of outlets out there and lots of outlets that are able to approach the news from different perspectives. And we saw it, you know, Indira mentioned the issue of the border issues and taking children away from their parents. A lot of what happened was, you know, the president was attracted into that position, but it was because the media was out there telling these stories, showing the pictures, ProPublica getting the audio of what it sounded like when a child was taken away from their parents, that moved the president to action, right? So there's still a role for independent media. And I think, you know, and Robert mentioned that everyone now who has a smartphone is a publisher and a producer and broadcaster. That's true. And how do you use those to your advantage? We saw it with the Parkland students in Florida as well, that they were able to control their own narrative because they were very adept, as teenagers, they were adept at using those technologies and putting their own story out there. So I think from my perspective, that while there are a lot of concerns, there's also a lot of reason for hope that the technology also provides new opportunities for protecting the First Amendment.
I'd like to get each of your takes on something that Robert brought up, journalists versus media. And does that complicate the issue? Does it muddy the waters? Are people, are consumers just sort of linking them all together? Indira, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. As Robert said, the term media is sort of too all-encompassing, and it refers to entertainment and, you know, all sorts of stuff that you find on the internet that is not actually news. You know, I think Andy's right to stress that innovation and new platforms that are out there provide a sort of democratization in a way that anyone can create news. The problem is, not everyone, I hate to say this, but not all news is equal. You know, not anybody creating news on their phone has the same credibility as an organization like Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting that Robert works for, or like the publications that both Andy and I have worked for. So, you know, there is a difference in quality that's out there. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Like, now people are using smart speakers and saying, play me the news. The speaker is not necessarily going to go to a credible news organization. It might be just pulling up random things. So I am concerned about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of this challenge is that, you know, we're talking about journalism and the media, but there's also, I would call it, I'm not sure what you want to say, there's an audience problem. But, you know, this divide where people are going to what they believe in is really crucial. We can create as much journalism, content, media companies as we want, but I think what we're seeing now more than ever, because of ease of access, people going to the information they agree with. And I think it's a big challenge for journalists, and I'll say journalists, to really help figure out how do you get people to actually listen to each other and hear each other, because, you know, we have a divisive leadership right now in the country. I mean, the political strategy is really around division. And as media or journalists, we're sort of caught in the middle. And I think there are people who trust journalism, they trust some media, but a lot of it's based on their political point of view. And I think, you know, part of this challenge for the audience is when you hear, and with cable television, the talking heads constantly, you know, and are people, do they think that's journalism? Do they think that's media? Is it entertainment? But they're tremendously influential. When you look at people like Alex Jones or Sean Hannity or even Rachel Maddow from the other side, are they journalists? But I do think that, you know, the leadership of news organizations now really do have to think about how do we help bridge the divide in communities and get people to actually listen and respect each other, or we're going to be in a really ugly situation. And history really shows what happens when we're in these kinds of situations.
Kevin, we're kind of talking about this at a macro level, which is relevant, but I think it's also important to remember that for a lot of people, you know, journalism is local, right? It's your local newspaper, your local community. And what we're seeing here in Western Pennsylvania is being repeated across the country where there's not a local news source. You know, we've done work from Point Park, doing work down in McKeesport, where it was a city of 20,000 people that had its own newspaper, but for the last 3 years has no local news source. And the impact that has on local residents is that they don't know what's going on. We talk with the seniors down there and they say, well, we don't know that our friends have died until they're dead and buried and long in the ground. And the young people there are talking about the problems that they have with violence and community issues and nobody really addressing those. And even the public officials who you think would be like, oh, thank goodness, nobody's paying attention to us. But in reality, they're having trouble getting their own stories out. And so when we talk about these, you know, threats to the First Amendment and the role of communities and citizen journalists, you know, there was a time when we talked about citizen journalists as sort of a thing that, you know, as traditional journalists, we're like, you can't be doing this because you don't have the training, you don't have the background. But in places where there is no other outlet, you know, there's nobody there doing the news, then the citizens have to rise up and take care of their own news and they have to provide their own news support. And so I think one of the challenges for us is to get the public, make them not only aware of real news versus fake news and how do you trust reliable sources, but also how do you use these technologies that you have in a responsible way, you know, ground them in that background of traditional journalism that we all grew up with.
To what Andy just said, there's actually a study that just came out of Notre Dame, which is really interesting, which shows that in the communities where local news outlets have died, that the cost of government has gone up. And, you know, you see a direct line correlation between people not having information and not having people, journalists, who are holding public officials accountable to the cost of government increasing for all taxpayers. So the death of local news and the desertification that we see across America, where there are so many communities that don't have local news outlets, is a huge problem. It's something that Poynter is working on and that, you know, many journalism nonprofits are trying to find a solution for that. But I think, you know, stepping back again to the 30,000-foot view, because I spent my career as a foreign correspondent and a national correspondent in Washington, my thought is about the way in which things like cable news, talking head shows, where you've got 6-9 people in what looks like Hollywood squares, is sort of polluting the larger information ecosystem. People watch that. They see people shouting at each other. I agree with Robert. It's more entertainment, if you find that entertaining, than it is actually news. It's not well labeled. People don't understand that that is opinion. They don't get that that's not news. And, you know, I can be on one of those shows next to some people who are political activists. And it's like, no, it's not the same. I'm a journalist. They're political activists. Why are we being put on the same screen with no differentiation of what we do? So that's a real concern. I'm also really interested in why public trust in journalism has gone down. Because if the public doesn't trust the media, and we did some original research at Poynter that shows that 44% of Americans, so think about that, almost half of Americans think that journalists fabricate stories. stories about President Trump. You know, majorities, particularly the majority of Republicans, don't trust news and information. You're in a really dangerous situation if the press is out there reporting the facts, reporting the news, and you have particularly one political party that doesn't believe they're telling the truth. So we have some larger problems that we have to deal with in our own houses, sort of be more transparent about how we collect and how we find information, be more transparent about the whole process of journalism as ways of building trust.
Okay. I want to talk about the muddying of sources. Do consumers know the difference between news reporting and editorial board comments? This, of course, as you know, came up in Pittsburgh recently with the firing of editorial cartoonist Rob Rogers. But it not only made a lot of attention, got a lot of attention here, but across the nation. So how do you deal with that muddying? And also, is an editorial board the bigger question? Is it necessary for a newsroom, for a community?
Well, traditionally, obviously, it was sort of the opinion place in a newspaper. I was the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the editorial board actually reported to me. And we had a fantastic cartoonist, Tony Auth, who won the Pulitzer Prize. And I can tell you that he knew when he drew a cartoon that it was going to create a S storm. And those are the ones he'd bring to me. And I never stopped him, but I really wanted to understand what he was doing. I think the editorial board, as sort of a voice of the community, historically and traditionally, played a really important role in the age of newspapers. That's been blurred a lot because of the technology. But I do think there's a place for opinion, and the divide in the public wouldn't understand it between being on the editorial board and being a reporter. There really was a wall. I worked at the Globe. And I remember times where the editorial board would be basically attacking my stories. I'm not going to get into all the details, but it didn't feel good. But I think there was a role. But again, the public, I think now with what we're seeing, really doesn't understand that, most of the public.
Robert, let me insert here that at least with the paper, people can, if they want, see that here's the news, here's the editorial section. Mm-hmm. But something that Indira said, lumping analysts, commentators with journalists, with reporters, that can sort of blur that situation for, I think, the consumers.
I think it does blur it.
And yeah, let's be honest. Most people don't read a paper newspaper. I mean, Andy can talk a lot more about this from the digital innovation side. But even I, you know, as a professional journalist, I read everything online now. And it's not very clear what's news and what's opinion, particularly if you're getting it through your social feed. If you're clicking on articles via Facebook or Twitter, you don't necessarily know where it comes from. This is why I think that the work of a woman called Sally Lerman, who's running something called the Trust Project, is so important, which is encouraging news organizations to actually label everywhere on their digital product whether something is news or opinion. I mean, as a columnist for the Boston Globe, I report up to the editorial page editor at the Globe, who is a completely separate line from the Boston Globe editor-in-chief. At many newspapers, it's separate. That's true at the Post-Gazette, for example. So David Shribman, the editor of the Post-Gazette, can say genuinely that he never reads the editorial page, and he doesn't need to because they're not under him. Obviously, we can have an entire conversation about the controversies in this town about the editorial page. I do think there is a role for editorial pages. You can call me old-fashioned, but I think there is something about people who are thinking hard, doing research. As long as it is fact-based, I'm in favor of smart opinion. People don't have to follow it. It should be clearly labeled, but I still think it's a contribution to the community, particularly when it's rooted in and written by people who know the community.
Yeah, Kevin, I mean, I think in terms of the editorial board, it is important to have that for a community, but the advantage we have now is this diversity of voices that's out there that wasn't there before. If you think previously, 10 years ago, if, you know, many cities across the United States, there was only one major newspaper in town. And so if the publisher of that newspaper didn't want something out there, if the publisher didn't want Rob Rogers cartoons to appear, well, that community really didn't get Rob Rogers cartoons, right? And they didn't get that perspective. But the reality now is that when the Post-Gazette didn't run Rob's cartoons, he was still putting them out on social media. He still had an outlet for them. People could actually see his work and see, oh, this is why the Post-Gazette didn't want to run them, because they didn't agree with what he was saying in his cartoons. And I think what we're going to see, I know Rob, that the same day he was fired by the Post-Gazette, had multiple offers from other places coming in and saying, hey, do your drawings for us. Come in and let your voice be heard here. That's something that didn't exist before. It's something that's exciting. It's something that allows different voices that before had no chance to be heard, now have a chance to be out there and have a diversity of voices in our community.
So let me ask, go ahead, Robert.
I'm changing the subject slightly. I just want to make a point that we're talking about the threats to the First Amendment, threats to the press, and I just want to be clear that there are what I would call political threats, but the reality, and Andy mentioned this earlier, is that the financial threat over the last 20 years has been the demise of the business model for newspapers and advertising declining. And that's really what's led to communities losing their local news, their regional news coverage. So the combination of the political environment we're in, as well as the real collapse of the business model, has really created these news deserts. And that, to me, is combined as a tremendous threat to really what the press has meant in American democracy.
When I think for the future, just that's why it's so important for individuals, you know, as your listeners out here, Kevin, they have to realize that they have a role in the media, in journalism, right? That this is no longer just a one-way process where news outlets are giving them information. They have to be engaged with it. They have to have a financial responsibility in it, and they also have to have their voices be heard.
And on the flip side, in a sense, the scope of investigative reporting seems to be expanding despite some of the cuts to the legacy media, or is it just sort of filling in the gap, shall we say, the nonprofit media, the nonprofit reporter?
Yeah, I mean, I when I went to the Center for Investigative Reporting 11 years ago, there were seven people, and it was the height of the recession, and people thought I was crazy. I was the executive director, but today CIR has over 70 people, and you know, pound for pound, we do more investigative reporting than probably any big newsroom or which are left. ProPublica obviously is a powerhouse that was created 11 years ago. So there has been a realization in philanthropy and people who believe in the role of the press and democracy to grow investigative reporting. But that doesn't make up for the news deserts in communities all around the United States that don't have any journalists working. So there is a positive upside, and the ability to publish, obviously, is much less expensive for the web-based nonprofits, but there's no dearth of material. There's no dearth of stuff to look into.
Indira and Andy, I want to ask you, do you think that this adversarial role between President Trump and the media at large, or most of the media, has affected investigative reporting? Has it given them, you know, has it re-energized them? Has it changed their approach to not just double-check, triple-check facts?
Yes. I mean, that I don't know if we want to call it a silver lining, but it is true that in the face of so many lies and untruths being repeated to the public, not just about the media, but about reality, that journalism has really sort of stepped up to the plate, not only with more funding for nonprofit newsrooms like Robert's and the excellent work that they're doing. And by the way, I just want to say that on this question of the migrant children, the best things that have come out of it have been ProPublica managing to get tape from inside one of those detention centers of young children screaming for their mothers and fathers. That was the kind of audio that you could not stop listening to. It was like a moral imperative to hear it. It was one of the things, I'm sure, that ultimately forced the president's hand to overturn his own terrible policy. And the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal, by the way, had a terrific report on a lawsuit that shows that in one of these, or alleges that in one of these detention centers, that the children are actually being forcibly drugged with psychotropic drugs. So this is some terrific journalism and reporting that is coming out in face of an environment in which the press is under attack. But I think we can't lose sight of the larger problem is that even if journalism is out there, reporters are out there doing great journalism, the constant sort of relentless undercutting of our credibility from the highest office in the land and the president's entire administration, not only saying bad things about the press, but also doing things like seizing a reporter's email and phone records, which is a continuation, by the way, of a terrible and corrosive path taken by the Obama administration in going after suspected leakers and seizing journalists' files as part of that. All of that is bad, and it adds to an environment in which we see a decrease in belief in the First Amendment. When we, you know, in our Poynter Media Trust survey, we found that 25% of people surveyed were in favor of rolling back the First Amendment, you know, thought that the government should be able to take draconian steps like censor reports that they didn't like.
So how does that difficult sort of macro relationship, President Trump and the networks, et cetera, affect local reporting, even the freelancers, the smaller newsrooms? Andy, we'll start with you.
Well, so, I mean, one part of it is that it's encouraged everyone to get out and be more aggressive in terms of journalism. You know, there was the knock on the White House press corps in the past that they would just take whatever's coming out of the White House. And so what you're seeing now is that journalists are being more aggressive. They're being standing outside of that process and going their own direction and asking difficult questions. Robert mentioned earlier that, you know, in a lot of newsrooms, however, there are fewer people asking those questions, and that's the real challenge. And so at the local level, one of the problems is that there are fewer seasoned reporters there asking difficult questions. But on the other hand, given this environment we've got, it's encouraging journalists to go out there and think for themselves, to be more enterprising, to ask good questions, and so not just take whatever's coming from government. And that's not true for only what's going on in Washington, but you know, I see it with my students at Point Park. Whenever this started happening, we talked with them about, well, how do you handle it if the White House is coming out and saying you've got fake news, or what you're saying is made up? And their attitudes were that we need to double down on making sure we've got the information right, that we're not just taking their word for it, and that we're going out and finding our own sources of information, that we're finding our own news, and we're determining what's really happening in our communities rather than just letting the government or someone else come in and tell us what they think we should be saying.
All right, my final question to you. Where would you put yourself? Are you optimistic? Are you concerned about the future of the work that you do, that your colleagues do? We've been talking about the threats to the First Amendment, but are you optimistic that the media, the journalists can withstand these threats, or are you concerned?
Well, I'm concerned, but at the same time, historically, this adversarial relationship has existed. I think it's complicated now by a couple of things we've talked about: the financial collapse, the lack of local news coverage, the confusion sown by the ability to everybody to be a publisher. But at the same time, I don't think journalists, you know, really have a choice. The people who believe in what we do, and no journalist starts in journalism to get rich. It's really a calling. They believe they have a role in the democracy, and I think people will keep doing it. And from my point of view, it's absolutely crucial. And Indira mentioned the coverage in the last couple of weeks of what's happened at the border. That's an impact. There's a real result that came from many, many, many quarters. Pictures, audio, video, words can lead to change. Exposure is the thing that potentially can stop abuses. And again, if you look at history, the press is often the first institution targeted by autocrats. And, you know, in this country, it's been done in different ways. So when you ask, am I optimistic? I think it's just you have to go forward. We have to continue doing what we do as journalists.
Indira, can you afford not to be optimistic?
Look, I mean, as Robert said, we all do what we do because we're mission-driven, because it's a calling. We feel we have to do it. It's about uncovering the truth and sharing information with the public. So what we do is we're watchdogs. We're supposed to be the eyes and ears of the public. So, of course, I'm optimistic that there are going to continue to be generations of people who feel the same way that everyone sitting at this table feels, that we're going to feel driven to get out there and tell important stories. The part where I don't know whether I would say pessimistic, but I don't know what's going to happen, is digital disruption. It's impossible to know. There have been so many changes to the news landscape because of digital over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And the news model, as we talked about, the revenue model has collapsed and is being recreated. So in that respect, I would say that I'm unsettled. I don't know which direction it's going to go, because I don't know how news is going to be able to sustain itself, and whether the American public is going to understand how important it is to pay for news. You can't just get it for free. Journalists need to actually, you know, live. And so that means we have to be paid. And that's something that I think people don't appreciate enough, that you do have to pay to get good news.
And Andy, finally, as a journalist, but also as a teacher.
Right. So for so long, we've talked about the disruption and the decline of local media. You and I both lost so many friends who worked in journalism who now are in public relations or doing something completely different. But over the last year and a half, I've really started to feel optimistic about it. You know, you look at the Pittsburgh landscape, there are more than a dozen new news startups here in Pittsburgh. These are groups that, in some cases, were people who used to work at traditional media and are now on their own. They're out there starting something brand new. They decided to do it around a narrow geographic niche. We talk about Ann Belzer and East End Print and what she's doing. Or you talk about the Incline and what they're doing on the north side in terms of taking a different approach to the news. That's an organization that has 5 to 7 reporters. You can also look at Public Source and what the work they're doing. It was interesting at the press club this year when they give out the annual awards, and for years it's always been the traditional media that have dominated this. And for the first time this year, we saw outlets that didn't even exist 2 years ago were not only among the finalists but among the winners. And in addition to that, we saw groups that or heard voices that didn't have a voice before. One of the winners was a woman. She does a podcast with Unabridged Press. She has Down syndrome. This is someone who wouldn't have had a voice in traditional media. But because technology has made all of this broadcasting equipment so accessible and so affordable, she's able to go out there and have her own voice be heard. And not only have it be heard, but do it in a way that's professionally competitive and that is quality. And so all of that makes me feel positive about the future.
Andy Conti is the founding director for the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University. Indira Lakshmanan teaches journalism ethics at the Poynter Institute, and she's a columnist for the Boston Globe. And Robert Rosenthal is a board member and executive producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting. All participants in the First Amendment for the 21st Century Conference, hosted by Pittsburgh Foundation and Heinz Endowments. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
And that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.